off and on throughout the day and no accumulation. A high of 28, west winds up to 20 miles per hour. Pretty windy right now. Wind from the west at 8 miles an hour, gusting to 18, 28 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today is the monthly visit of our good friend Nan Calvert to the Morning Show. And Nan, as always, has brought along with her, of course, via the telephone, a really interesting guest to talk about one of the most, perhaps the most important of all resources, namely our water, our drinking water, our groundwater, and the importance of safeguarding the quality of our water. And towards that end, Nan has secured the participation today of someone from the Wisconsin DNR, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, Kyle Burton, who is Field Operations Director for the DNR's Drinking and Groundwater Program. And so we're going to be talking about the work that they do to help, in a sense, beat back some of the really dangerous contaminants that can really interfere with the quality of our drinking water. And we'll talk about a number of other related issues as well. So first of all, Nan Calvert, welcome back to the morning show.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody.
Good to have you here. And on the telephone, Kyle Burton from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Kyle, are you still with us?
I am. Good morning. Thank you so much for having me today.
We're glad that you can do this. So, Nan, tell us a little bit about what prompted this invitation for you to reach out to Kyle Burton at the DNR.
Sure. So, in the not too terribly distant past, I watched the film Dark Waters, which is a film about PFAS contamination, not in Wisconsin, but elsewhere. And it certainly has stayed with me since then. And then most recently, I heard a report about the Wisconsin DNR implementing a mapping system for PFAS contamination in the state. And so I thought it was really important for people to know about that, to know about what PFAS are. It's a whole family of chemicals. And to know where they come from and what can be done about them. I think one of the most concerning things to me, and there are a lot of reasons to be concerned about PFAS, is that they seem to be ubiquitous. They are found in so very many places that Kyle will talk about, and that they are not naturally occurring anywhere on this globe. So that sets up a whole slew of difficulties, challenges in terms of mitigating them and working to remove them from the environment and lessening the impact they have. PFAS are found in soil, in water, in air, and they're found everywhere, essentially, at this point. And so because it is of global concern and certainly a state concern as well, I thought it was a really important thing for us to talk about and raise awareness.
Very good. Well, that's why we're here. So again, Kyle Burton, we're really glad that you can join us on the morning show to shed some light on this important topic. Before we dig into some of the specifics of what Nan just laid out, let's find out a little bit about you, maybe on a more personal level, where you're from originally, and in particular, what kind of drew you to be interested in kind of the natural world around you, and ultimately, of course, led you to do this work with Wisconsin DNR.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you so much. Originally, I am from the northeast part of Wisconsin, the Green Bay area. Just over 20 years ago, I came out of college with a background in environmental science and policy, and was fortunate enough to get an internship with the Department of Natural Resources. And I really kind of fell in love with their mission, our mission here at the agency, which is to protect and enhance our natural resources as well as to provide a healthy and sustainable environment. And working for the drinking water program specifically, our role in that is something that I have great passion for, which is to ensure the safety and availability of Wisconsin's drinking water supplies and to protect the health of our water resources here in Wisconsin. So it's been a 20-year-plus career so far working with the Department of Natural Resources. And I just really enjoy the folks that I work with here, all of our passion for protecting Wisconsin's natural resources and public health, and just am I'm very pleased to be able to have that opportunity.
So was this interest in the natural world and environmental well-being, is this something that's been a passion of yours pretty much all of your life, or can you point to something or someone that kind of lit the fire underneath you?
Yeah, you know, for me, I've always been kind of an outdoors type person. Spent a lot of time on the water as a young person, recreating, fishing, camping, hunting. So it felt to me natural to go to work with the Department of Natural Resources, or at least see what it's all about. And when I got there, I just saw the good work being done by the folks here at the agency protecting our natural resources, and then really fell into that sense of purpose behind protecting our state's drinking water sources and the health of its people. It's really been just kind of the community and the mission behind this. I really found a connection to, and it was something that I still really have a passion for, and I'm really thankful to be able to have the opportunity to do so.
So outline for us what the primary mission is of the DNR's drinking water and groundwater program. What are the specific issues and concerns that occupy your time and energy?
Well, our long-term goal, our overarching goal, is to ensure that everyone in Wisconsin has access to safe and sustainable water supplies and to protect our state's water resources. And to do that, we have several partitions within our program. We have a large group of folks that work directly with public water supplies, with those municipal water supplies, those businesses that supply their own water to their customers, from the largest municipality in Wisconsin, Milwaukee, to the smallest corner bar that has a well. Those are all public water systems, and we work directly with those public water systems to make sure that they're supplying safe drinking water to their customers. And we also work ensuring that Wisconsin's over 800,000 private wells are drilled in a way that it's designed to provide safe drinking water to those folks who have their own really small public water utility. You know, they're serving themselves water, giving them the information they need to continue to obtain safe and sustainable drinking water, as well as making sure those folks that are installing or creating those wells for them do it in a way that helps ensure safe drinking water in the future. And we also have a part of our program that works with quantity, groundwater quantity. We work to try to ensure that we understand the amount of water that's being withdrawn from our state's aquifers and that it's being returned in the same watershed, to make sure tracking our withdrawals and knowing our state's groundwater supplies and making sure that they remain sustainable and healthy. Hmm.
I know that one of the primary elements in what you just described is data, and in particular drinking water data, measuring the quality of Wisconsin's drinking water. Explain to our listeners how that's done, the kind of information that is necessary, and how that information is, in a sense, sort of gathered and processed, so we can, in a sense, numerically understand the quality of the water we're drinking.
Absolutely. Thank you for that question. In terms of public water systems, municipal water systems specifically, there are federal health-based numbers that are out there that we compare drinking water samples too. So all of our public water systems in the state of Wisconsin, which we have over 11,000 public water systems in the state of Wisconsin, the most or nearly the most in the nation, regularly sample their drinking water for a suite of contaminants, regulated contaminants, and some unregulated contaminants. That data comes to us, and we're able to take a look at that data, compare it to those maximum contaminant levels or health-based numbers, and ensure that those drinking water sources are providing drinking water that meets those standards. And if they're not, then we work with those water providers to take corrective actions to help reduce those contaminants in the drinking water and ensure that in the future that water will be safe for customers to use. Hmm.
So when we're talking about the presence of contaminants in drinking water, what are we talking about in terms of the amount, generally speaking, the amount of contaminants? And what is the threshold of contaminants that in a sense are safe or pose no significant threat to human well-being?
Well, our annual drinking water report, annually our program puts out a drinking water quality report for public water systems, and over 98% of our drinking water systems in Wisconsin have no health-based violations, which means they're serving drinking water below all maximum contaminant levels or health-based numbers. So that's a good thing, right? That's something we want to celebrate. But there are contaminants out there in our environment. There are naturally occurring contaminants like arsenic and radium that may contaminate drinking water systems. There are also contaminants that come from land use activities like maybe nitrate or even chemical spills where we're running into gasoline type or VOC type contaminants. So that's why we collect the data, so we can monitor the results and be able to work with those public water systems to really reduce the amount of contamination that is being served to customers.
You may have touched on this in what you were just saying, but I just want to clarify. At the outset, you made reference to regulated contaminants and unregulated contaminants. Can you explain that a little further, clarify the difference? And when we're talking, for instance, about unregulated contaminants, is there any particular reason why they are not regulated? Is it that they just don't need to be because they are? I mean, I guess part of it is maybe we need to fully understand the term contaminants. And yeah. Are contaminants always a bad thing? Or are some contaminants just kind of a part of the natural order and not a problem at all?
Let me start with just there are aesthetic contaminants. So that's like the sulfur taste in your water or the high iron in your water. Those things that really make water, give it a little bit of hardness, maybe undesirable water, but the health effects of those, they're public welfare or aesthetic contaminants. Now, there are also health-based contaminants or health or public health contaminants that, at levels above certain numbers, have the opportunity or the risk of creating adverse health effects. Now, when we get into other unregulated contaminants, sometimes regulation hasn't caught up with science. And that's the case when we're talking about PFAS or perfluoroalkyl substances, which are a group of man-made chemicals used for decades in numerous products, including nonstick cookware, fast food wrappers, stain-resistant sprays, certain types of firefighting foam, really ubiquitous in our environment. And recently, many of these contaminants have made their way into the environment through spills of PFAS-containing chemicals, discharges of PFAS-containing wastewater to treatment plants, and certain types of firefighting foams. And as the science, as we begin to study these compounds more and more, we're finding that they also have a risk to public health at certain levels. Hmm.
when there is an issue in a given public system of drinking water, is it more often that your testing, that is the DNR's testing, detects an issue, or is it more often that members of the public detect an issue in terms of the water looks funny or smells funny or tastes funny, and that alerts you to a potential problem that you then investigate? Is one scenario more common than the other?
It's most of our contaminants, Greg, are really undetectable to the human taste in drinking water, so we won't know that they're there. So it's the sampling that is done by the public water utility, public water system, which is then provided to us and the public water system, and it's those results that generally tip us off to a situation where we want to take some action.
Let's talk about something else that is an aspect of what you do, which is namely the matter of construction, when new construction is underway to create or expand a drinking water system, and that needs to be done within certain carefully constructed guidelines. Talk us through sort of what that process looks like and the kind of safeguards that are put in place at that point in the process, and why they are so important.
Yeah, really, we have two types of construction standards for drinking water systems in Wisconsin, and one is for private water wells, which are, if you built a house in a country, you weren't connected to a municipal system, you would need your own well. And we have a group of people that work with us in our program that work directly with well drillers. We have a very intricate code that well drillers have to follow when they're constructing wells, to make sure that those wells are constructed in a way that they are providing safe drinking water. We also track all kinds of data across the program to understand where there may be contamination in the across the layout of the state, and have put in special construction requirements if we know folks are trying to or wanting to build or live in an area where there may be groundwater contamination, so we can construct those wells in a way that either are drilled deeper and through the contamination, or in some cases in the arsenic area, drilled shallower and above where the contamination is. So we really want to provide our partners out there, whether it be well drillers or homeowners, with the best information we can when it comes to constructing a private water supply. On the public water side, we work really much more on a case-by-case basis. So a public water utility that wants to construct a new drinking water source generally has to come to us with their plans and specifications for constructing that source, and we really work as a partnership using all the data that we have, and as well as construction standards that are standardized around the country, really, and some specific to Wisconsin, to construct that drinking water source in a way that it's designed to provide safe and sustainable drinking water for the customers of that public water utility for years to come.
Kyle, you mentioned arsenic, and there are areas where arsenic contaminates private wells. Can people access that data on the DNR website? Is there a mapping program for that, in the sense that the DNR is working on a mapping program for PFAS contamination?
There is, and it's really better known with our well drillers. There is information about arsenic on our website, mm-hmm. Certainly. And we really work with our well drillers. Arsenic was a project that was just kicking off when I came into the department in the late 90s and early 2000s, and we did a really nice job of determining where in the aquifer or where in the subsurface that naturally occurring arsenic occurred, and designing well construction standards to get us in a situation where those wells were not being negatively impacted by that naturally occurring arsenic.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about this mapping program that's going on for
sure.
PFAS, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, thank you so much. So We talked a little bit about PFAS, that group of man-made chemicals that includes over 5,000 compounds. And it's one of those, what we call an emerging contaminant. And it's generally, it's not unregulated anymore. Wisconsin just recently passed a rule that requires public water systems to sample for PFAS and sets a maximum contaminant level. So we're beginning to regulate it on the state side. The federal EPA is also working through a process to create nationwide or federal requirements. And PFAS, like you said, man, they're ubiquitous. They're everywhere. And there's something, research has been going on, and they've identified that there may be some negative health impacts when folks are exposed to high levels of PFAS. Some of those negative health impacts include increased cholesterol levels, decreasing how well our body responds to vaccines, increase of thyroid disease, connection to some types of cancer, and then also health risks for women who can be or are or could become pregnant. And we are exposed to PFAS, all of us are exposed to PFAS every day, but some of the main ways that we can be exposed to PFAS include drinking contaminated drinking water, eating fish that have high levels of PFAS in them because they live in a surface water body where there is high levels of PFAS found. Also, there are areas of the state where private wells have been contaminated by PFAS. And we've been collecting this data now for some time, and we've had that data kind of in our data systems and on our websites in several locations. And we really have been working through, Wisconsin has a PFAS action plan that recommended investing in communicating the information that we have out to our customers in a simple way to access. So what we did is we put together an interactive map that drew from all of our data sources to be able that customers or people in the public could access to really get a good feel of what PFAS information we have out there. Where is PFAS? Where are our fish advisories? Where are we working on groundwater contamination sources? Which public water utilities have sampled for PFAS, and what are those results? So we really wanted to put that information in the hands of our engaged constituency so they could understand what we have, know what we know, and make decisions based on the information that we have.
Before we dig into more of the present day, my understanding from looking at the website is that PFAS are nothing new, that they have been widely utilized for decades. Explain kind of the timeline and how and why they are now attracting so much attention. Is it that they are used much more extensively than they were half a century ago? Or is it that we understand their significance more than we did, for instance, a half century ago?
Yeah, I think you hit on it really well at that second point. The family of PFAS compounds have been around since about the 1940s. They were kind of a groundbreaking development for companies to be able to offer. If we think back to when we first had non-stick cookware, waterproof jackets, waterproof shoes, stain-resistant carpet. These are things that made our lives much easier, much more. We were able to live in an easier way because of some of these compounds. And as these compounds were used and got into our environment, we started to study their impacts of being in the environment and also people being exposed to them in high levels, and found that there is a connection to adverse health effects when consuming PFAS at high levels.
Hmm. Maybe you could outline for our listeners the primary ways in which PFAS are used. I mean, where they show up kind of in our day-to-day lives before we get into the matter of exactly how they infiltrate and contaminate our water supply.
Sure. I want to start with saying two of the most common and the most studied PFAS compounds, PFOA and PFOS, they've generally been phased out in production in the United States. Those are the two that we're seeing that at lower levels can be harmful to consumers. But that doesn't mean they're still not in the environment. But I just wanted to make the point that they're generally not being manufactured in the United States anymore. But PFAS can be found in everyday products such as cleaning products, water-resistant fabrics such as rain jackets, umbrellas, and tents, grease-resistant paper, your fast food wrappers, nonstick cookware, like I said before. They're also present in things like personal care products, shampoo, dental floss, nail polish, eye makeup, stain-resistant coatings used on carpets and upholstery and other fabrics. Things as even as minor as ski wax can be sources of PFAS. Now, that all being said, the way people can be exposed is through ingestion of PFAS. So, like I said, drinking contaminated water or water with high levels of PFAS, or eating those fish with high levels of PFAS. Sometimes eating food packaged in materials made with PFAS, or eating food grown or raised near places that PFAS were made or released into the environment. Those are the exposures that can be problematic. PFAS isn't a dermal contaminant. It doesn't hurt you by touching your skin, but ingestion of high levels of PFAS is where we worry about health risks.
So it certainly gives me pause when I think about my raincoat or my umbrella or whatever. So knowing that it's part of water resistance or waterproofing, the shoes I'm wearing right now, are PFAS sort of leaking out of them, you know, with all of these chemicals, all of our stain resistance and, you know, covers all of our car seats and all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Is that how they get into the environment, or does it?
Generally, they'll get in, you know, I don't think dangerous levels of PFAS, Nan, are coming off of your shoes.
Not mine particularly, anyway.
Or my shoes, yeah. or my Gore-Tex jacket, or any, you know, I think where we run into issues with PFAS is contamination from large-scale uses or manufacturing, mm-hmm. or maybe storage of waste. These larger-scale situations where we have a lot of PFAS stored in one spot and there's a breakdown in that storage, or maybe firefighting foam. PFAS has been in certain types of firefighting foam for many years, and there was some training exercises done outside over the years and years and years where PFAS was, you know, federally, the foam containing PFAS was required by the Federal Aviation mm-hmm. Bureau to do a test, and they would test it outside, put a fire out on the ground, and not realizing that there could be harmful contaminants in that PFAS. So we're really looking at those larger type situations where contamination is happens, and that's what has the most opportunity to impact our daily lives when it comes to PFAS contamination.
It's interesting to me that it's also found in shampoo and things, other things that come in contact with water. You know, and you think about there being, at this point, 8 billion people on the planet, most of whom are using shampoo. It seems like it would be, you know, that's a significant entry point for water contamination as well, not only with manufacturing, accidental spills, purposeful applications, and that sort of thing. So it's easy to understand why it's become ubiquitous.
Right.
Well, right. I mean, you're using shampoo and that, what, the suds come right off your body and right down the drain, and it seems like the perfect pathway for it.
So are there, you know, when someone is using shampoo, dental floss, cosmetics, even I read in toothpaste, when we look at the ingredient list on those products, is there a way to tell if there is one of those, if there are some of those 5,000 different kinds of PFAS in the ingredient list, or would that just be impossible to figure out from just from the back of a bottle?
You know, I think it's difficult. I'm not an expert when it comes to personal care products and those very, very long words that are generally listed in the fine print of the ingredients. But mm-hmm. what I can tell you is that I am seeing, just personal experience shopping, I am seeing pots and pans being advertised as PFAS-free or PFOA-free. So, I think our market is starting to catch up with the idea that some of these compounds can be harmful. And, you know, I think there is information out there for consumers that are looking for ways to reduce their usage of PFAS. Mm-hmm. I think information can be found out there by looking for that.
So tell us about the genesis of the mapping program, where it stands today, and then, of course, what can be done about water contaminated with PFAS.
Sure. So, like I mentioned earlier, Wisconsin has a PFAS action plan that really talked about wanting to communicate our data to our customers. And we continue to gather data, and we wanted to make that data, that information, easier to access for communities, policymakers, other stakeholders, the general public, so they can make informed decisions to help minimize their exposure. So that was really the impetus for the interactive data viewer. Put all of our information in one spot. You can look where you live. If you live in a city, you can look to see if they sampled for PFAS. You can look to see if there's any groundwater contamination that includes PFAS in or around your city. You can look to see if there's been any surface water or fish tissue sampling in the river that goes through your community to understand what those levels are. So all that information now is in one spot, relatively easy to use and understand with a few clicks to really give people the same information that we have and that we've been collecting for some time.
So would you be able to tell us, for instance, if there have been particular hot spots or trouble spots in the state of Wisconsin in which this PFAS contamination has been especially acute and maybe an exceptional cause for concern?
You know, I don't know that we have an exceptional cause for concern. We don't really have the data to be able to make those types of assessments. We have, right now, we kind of have had, we've been kind of chasing PFAS contamination. So we get a hot spot and we sample around there and we find it in that area. And that feels like a hot spot. But we don't know because we don't have that full breadth of data from the entire state. So we wouldn't be able to, we can tell you, or the data viewer can tell you by looking at it, where we have found it. And as we continue to gather data, we'll be able to make those types of assumptions or those types of determinations. Hey, this is an area that we really think it's here for a certain reason. And those reasons may be because there were PFAS manufacturing there, or manufacturing that used PFAS, or near a spot where there was a giant fire where PFAS foam is used, and as well as there being a vulnerable aquifer when it comes to drinking water. Much of our drinking water in the state lays just feet below the surface in a relatively unprotected aquifer, so it's easy for that water to get contaminated.
How would you compare this particular threat to other things that we hear about, such as fertilizer and insecticide runoff, storm runoff, or things like lead pipes, which we also hear something about, yeah. Maybe not so much in the state of Wisconsin, but certainly in other places like Flint, Michigan, where that has been a very serious scourge on drinking water quality. I mean, is the threat of PFAS contamination comparable to those? Greater? Not as significant?
And that's a tough question to answer. It really is. You know, we do have acute contaminants, you know, those contaminants that can make you sick right away with just small levels. Those include things like bacteria. And for some people, for some parts of the population, nitrate can be very acute, right? If you have, think of salmonella or E. coli poisoning, right? Those are acute. Those can make us sick right away. And then there are what we call chronic contaminants that by drinking water over the period of your lifetime or over a long period of time, your chances increase of having adverse health effects. Those things are like things like arsenic at certain levels, like your organic and inorganic compounds that have a chance to increase your risk over the period of your lifetime. But there are also contaminants like PFAS and lead, where we're not quite sure if, well, I guess we are with lead. Our health professionals will tell us there's no safe source. There's no safe level of lead. Lead is a contaminant that's we're very concerned about. It's not one that'll make you sick right away unless it's at very high levels. But it's one that we'd like to, you know, that's why we're seeing many communities getting the lead out, removing their lead service lines, removing lead from their drinking water system because there's no safe level of lead. With PFAS, the recommended numbers or even the regulated numbers around the country that have been put in by states are very low. So the levels of PFAS measured in the parts per trillion, which is one drop of water in several Olympic swimming pools. So it's very low. So those levels are very low. It can be very dangerous or very have significant health impacts for people at very low levels.
Interesting. Are we seeing this concern across the country, or would you, and maybe you're not in a position to know this, but do you have some sense that Wisconsin is a leader when it comes to concerns about this and taking proactive action over this?
I certainly think we are taking significant action in the state of Wisconsin. PFAS is a state of Wisconsin issue. It's a national issue. Many states around the country have collected data, instituted their own regulations, and it's also a global issue. I was just reading an article the other day about PFAS contamination in Italy, and many of the same issues that are being seen around the world are things that we're dealing with here right in Wisconsin. So it's an issue. Actions being taken around the state, around the country, around the world in response to PFAS contamination.
So, Kyle, let's say that a hot spot is identified in drinking water or in groundwater. What kinds of things can be done to lower the levels of PFAS or remove them altogether, at least to a non-injurious level?
Thank you so much for bringing me back to the good news, Nan. The good news is we can get it out of our water. We can get it out of our drinking water. There are acceptable treatment techniques out there that we know remove it from our drinking water. We have at least one public utility in the state of Wisconsin that is already treating its water for PFAS, removing that PFAS that they know is in their water that they did through voluntary testing. We have many other communities in the state of Wisconsin that are working on putting in treatment design to take out PFAS, some in response to higher levels of PFAS found through voluntary testing, some just proactively wanting to make sure that PFAS doesn't become an issue for them down the road. We have large utilities around the country that have been operating PFAS treatment systems for periods of years now, successfully removing PFAS. We also have information out on our partner agency's website, Department of Health Services, about in-home treatment. If you have your own private well and you happen to sample for PFAS and you want to be able to treat for that, there's information out there about treatments you can put on your faucet, treatments you can put under your sink that'll help remove PFAS from your drinking water.
So it is a matter of filtration then?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Carbon, granulated activated carbon is one of the most commonly used and commonly accepted ways to remove PFAS. Of course, I would really want people to understand that just putting a carbon filter on your faucet or in your refrigerator and leaving it for and forgetting about it for a long period of time is not a way to effectively remove PFAS. Anytime you're treating for any contaminants, it's so important to maintain that treatment as the manufacturer specifications describe. Otherwise, you could end up getting yourself in a situation where you're actually worse off. Maintenance of treatment systems is very important.
And then maintaining the treatment system when it's time to change your filter, how should the used one be disposed of?
Yeah, those are great questions that we get asked quite a bit, and things that we're working on, and they're really being working on nationwide. And the best answer for disposing of any PFAS filter or PFAS-related product is to send it out with your trash that goes to a licensed and regulated waste facility. Now, our landfills are designed to minimize any runoff into the environment, into the groundwater. They're designed and regulated, and really right now the best option that we have for PFAS waste.
Kyle, I think I understand that research into the effects of PFAS on wildlife in general is in sort of its infancy. Is that correct?
Yes. I think large-scale research into it is kind of just a recency thing. I know in Wisconsin, along the Mississippi River, there's been longer-term studies on it. But we have been doing, in Wisconsin specifically, in the recent years, been doing some fish tissue studies, mm-hmm. And found PFAS in higher levels in some fish species around the state. We actually have some PFAS specific fish consumption advice or advisories out there, similar to how we have fish advisories or advice for consumption around PCBs and mercury in the state. All that information can be found on our interactive web viewer. There is, as far as wildlife, I think it's probably a little bit more in its infancy. There was a study around one of our PFAS investigation sites a couple of years ago where we found that in a certain area, PFAS levels in the livers of deer were high, and there's a consumption advisory around that. And we've seen other things like that in states like Michigan. But in general, man, I think your statement was a correct one.
And so do PFAS bioaccumulate? In other words, the fish and deer and whatever else is impacted by them, they don't process it and eliminate it to a certain extent. It just continues accumulating?
They do. But PFAS, that's a very good point, one that I failed to make thus far. But thank you. PFAS do bioaccumulate in animals and people, which is why it is why in such low levels it has the ability to raise the risk of health risks. Hmm. So we do excrete them, but very slowly. That's why they're called bioaccumulative, and they build up in our bodies. And the more that build up in our bodies, the thought is, or research points to, that the higher the risk for adverse health effects.
Hmm. Well, you've shared a lot of important information with us today, and we really appreciate that. If people go to the Wisconsin DNR's website, dnr.wisconsin.gov, what kind of information can they find there to educate themselves still further?
Yeah, by just searching for, going to that website, dnr.wisconsin.gov, and searching for PFAS, you'll get to our interactive viewer, you get to our PFAS page, which highlights our interactive viewer, so you can bump around there and find where we've been working on PFAS contamination. We also have all of our drinking water data at your fingertips, so you can go to our dnr.wisconsin.gov and search drinking water and type in the city that you live in. You can see all of the PFAS sampling data. You can see all of the water quality data that your community has collected over the years. We really try to get as much information out there for our customers as possible.
Fantastic. Kyle Burton is Field Operations Director for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Drinking and Groundwater Program. Kyle, thank you so much for making time in your really busy schedule to be a part of our morning show today. It's been really great to talk with you.
Very happy to be here. Thank you so much for the invite. I enjoyed it.
Yes, thank you so much, Kyle.
My word, Nan, what a fantastic guest, Kyle Burton from the Wisconsin DNR. You have to be pleased about that.
Yes, you know, what I'd like people to take away from this particular interview is that this is a very big problem. It's a huge challenge because PFAS, you know, the family of those chemicals, over 5,000 of them, are found everywhere now. But there are things that we can do just in our daily lives in order to lessen the impact. So one of them is if you have nonstick cookware and the surface, the nonstick surface is marred or scratched, get rid of it. Everything points to getting rid of those and replacing them with a different kind of cookware that doesn't contain PFAS. And of course, you know, cast iron is the old standby. Once they're seasoned, absolutely nothing sticks to them. And hopefully at some point in time, there will be consumer labeling that alerts us to a possible problem. There are PFAS contained in whatever it is that you're using. But just know that there are ways to mitigate it so that if you have your water tested, particularly if you live on a well, like I do, it's a simple fix, essentially. You know, it's a carbon filter. So yes, it's an enormous challenge, but we can do something about it. And the biggest thing we can do is limit our use of products insofar as we can that are manufactured with PFAS.
And hopefully some of those regulations will get tightened considerably, yes. So there'll be less of that out in the world. All right, let's get to a couple of announcements before we say goodbye.
Okay, it's very exciting, you know, because the holiday season is upon us. So Riverbend Nature Center has brought back its very popular program called Gifts of Nature that will happen on December 10th from 9 until noon. So just in time for the holidays, you can make up to 8 beautiful gifts using materials found in nature. The program is for everybody 7 years old and up. All materials are included in the program fee, which is $50 for members and $60 for those people who have yet to become members. In order to register, and yes, you do need to register because it fills up quickly, just go to the Riverbend website, and it's a point-and-click thing, very easy. And what a great way to make meaningful gifts and also support your local nature center. And here's another opportunity. Hawthorne Hollow's Holiday Boutique will be on December 3rd from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Santa Claus will be there from 10 a.m. till 1 p.m. And so there are beautiful, unique, handmade gifts, wreaths, swags, all kinds of things from materials on the ground. There will be homemade cookies, cakes, candies, great for gift giving. Avail yourself of that opportunity to have really beautiful things to give to the people that you love and support Hawthorne Hollow. The Racine Dominican Eco Justice Center is holding a needle felting alpaca ornament session. These also are beautiful and great for people's holiday trees. That will be on Saturday, December 3rd from 9 until 11:30. The cost is $20. You do have to register for that one as well. And it's for people from 12 years and up. Just, again, go to the website for the Racine Dominican Eco Justice Center, point and click, and you're in. And that's it.
Very good. Thank you, Nan Calvert, for that and for helping to arrange a really, really interesting morning show today.
Always my pleasure. Thank you so much.
We'll see you soon. It's 8:59 here on WGTD. And coming up tomorrow on the morning show, we'll have a couple of different interviews, including one with Public Radio's Rebecca Scheel, who is in charge of a wonderful podcast, which is called Circle Round. Circle Round gathers together an incredible array of folk tales from all around the world and presents them in really dramatic, wonderfully vivid fashion, primarily with young listeners in mind, but I know a lot of adults who love this podcast as well.